Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Corporate America tries to make its earnings more interesting. Christie's, the auction house, tries to make itself more relevant. And I try to stick up for the humble lemonade stand. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 16th of July. Good as always to have you with us. There is, I don't know if you've noticed, a certain rhythm to American capitalism. Not the boom and bust stuff, but the more pedestrian bits that make the whole system work. I'm talking here about the regular reporting of profits, or losses, as the case may be. The four times a year phenomenon that's come to be called earnings season. We're only in the second week of the most recent occurrence of that event, and a lot of investors are already, and journalists and analysts as well, were bored. Not by corporate results, but by the conference calls in which CEOs drone on and on, essentially rereading the news release they issued earlier that day. So some companies are trying to spice things up. Later this month, Netflix will ditch its earnings call for a conversation moderated by an analyst and a journalist. Yahoo is doing a live webcast of its earnings call today because it can. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports now on the changing nature of the corporate conference call.
Earnings calls are one of the ways companies talk to investors and the market.
They're more boring than boring. They're among the most boring things we've managed to create in the modern financial era.
Paul Kedrowski is an investor who listened to earnings calls for decades. He says they're boring by design and highly scripted. But now some tech companies are getting more adventurous.
Yahoo or Netflix, they're video stream. They're taking questions via email. You can tweet questions at them. They've opened up.
But he says open is a relative term. Mike Mayo is an analyst who's famous for asking bank CEOs pointed questions on earnings calls.
There's no question that these earnings calls are a controlled setting in which companies sometimes manipulate the order of the questions, will go to the analyst who ask softball questions first.
That won't necessarily change just because questions can be emailed. In fact, it may make it easier to ignore uncomfortable ones. Mary Beth Kassane is with Wallach & Associates, a financial PR firm. She views the new type of earnings call as simply an adaptation to online technology.
Folks trying to tell a company story and tell it well. It's always been hard to do, and anything that can help people to tease out an ability to try to do that better, I think, is a very good thing.
Watching executives talk about their earnings may not be more interesting than listening to them, but at least you'll be able to see them squirm at difficult questions. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
The Postal Service doesn't get a whole lot of love these days. It lost almost $16 billion last year, and then whenever it tries to close post offices or nicks Saturday delivery, all it gets is a fight from Congress. But never fear, USPS. The greeting card industry's got your back. It's pushing a list of 100 cost-cutting measures it thinks can keep everybody, especially itself, in business. Kate Davidson reports.
To really deliver a story like this, I immediately call my sources at Stationery Trends magazine. That's stationery with an E, of course. Editor Sarah Schwartz says the greeting card industry has enough challenges without all the postal woes.
There's definitely been a rise of e-cards. There's definitely been the rise of Facebook birthday greetings.
And when folks do buy greeting cards, 60% of them still get mailed. There's a lot at stake, and that's an invitation for concern. George White is chairman of the Greeting Card Association's Postal Affairs Committee, the group that compiled the cost-cutting measures. One of the biggest suggestions?
Postal cluster boxes.
Cluster boxes, grouped post boxes like you see outside apartment complexes, only all over the place.
It obviously saves a lot of time and therefore money for the mail delivery person to be able to put all the mail in the cluster boxes rather than delivering to each apartment door or to each house door.
The greeting card lobby's main goals are to save Saturday delivery and keep rates low. Postal analyst John Callen agrees that a landscape of cluster boxes would save big bucks.
Although I think it will be quite unpopular with a lot of the general public, those of us who enjoy receiving our mail and parcel delivered to our households would want to really give it up.
But something's probably got to go. Whether it's Saturday delivery, door-to-door service, or something else will be the subject of a hearing tomorrow on Capitol Hill. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, ixnay on the epi hey usic may. We'll have the details when we do the umbers nay. Late last month, the Army announced it's going to cut a dozen combat brigades from its active forces. You roll that in with the other changes the Pentagon's making as the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan wind down, and that's a total of 80,000 soldiers in all by 2017. The communities around military bases are already dealing with furloughs, thanks to the sequester, so they are doing what they can to get by. Luke Quinton has the story from KUT in Austin, Texas.
Fort Hood is like a city. It's home to more than 40,000 assigned soldiers, and the base brings $25 billion to the Texas economy each year. But it's about to lose a brigade. Bill Perry is with the Heart of Texas Defense Alliance. He says that's only 7% of Fort Hood's fighting force.
While I say it could be a lot worse, yes, we could have in fact lost 14% of our in strength. Or, God forbid, someplace like Fort Knox, Kentucky, which lost 43% of its assigned in strength.
No one in the supermarket bats an eye as the anthem is belted out near the produce aisle. It's part of a small ceremony to recognize veterans who work here. Ed Hill was in the Army for 23 years. Now he's the deli manager.
When I first came here, Killeen barely had a highway. Now they're building bridges in Corpus Cove. Or Harker Heights looks like a metropolis now. And it was a nothing here at first.
The town of Killeen is no metropolis, but there's a Target and a Sam's Club is on its way. There's Thai food and chain restaurants and Letitia Womack's home bakery. It all seemed unlikely a decade ago. But a few miles east of Tank Destroyer Boulevard, Womack will sell you gluten-free muffins?
Hi.
Hey, Letitia.
Nice to meet you.
You too. Thank you. Oh, it does smell good in here.
The strip of road that passes south of the base is tacky. You see pawn shops and tattoo parlors. There's hardly a tree in sight. As Bill Perry told me, these communities give soldiers what they need, whether it's healthcare, roads, or pawn shops. Military towns are a lot alike. So it's a surprise when I drive south and a sleek building rises out of the hills. It's all glass and limestone, and there's a second one just like it under construction next door.
My name is Mark Nigliazzo. I'm president of Texas A&M University, Central Texas. Everybody calls me Dr. Mark.
Dr. Mark points out this is the only public university for 100 miles in all directions. In 30 years, he expects 15,000 students. Folks here worked hard to bring changes like this.
During the first Gulf War, when families went home and people boarded up their stores, I think the area sort of made a decision at that point that they didn't want to see that happen again.
Dr. Mark said that Killeen's town leaders realized that it had to clean up its act.
If you surround us with tattoo parlors and beer joints, then the university will build a wall around itself. That's what universities do. Many have. But you have an incredible opportunity here to really integrate the two.
Not everyone's convinced. Womack, the gluten-free baker, lives here in Killeen because of her husband. She knows he may not be in the Army forever.
If he was to get a good job in Houston, we would move back to Houston.
In the last decade, 70,000 people have come here, but keeping them, that's the challenge. In Killeen, Texas, I'm Luke Quinton for Marketplace.
There was, not so long ago, on the scale at which changes in consumer electronics happen in this economy, great hope for 3D TV. And then there really wasn't any hope. The BBC has just announced it's suspending its three-dimensional broadcasts. ESPN killed theirs outright a couple of months ago. Carolyn Giardina is a contributing tech editor at The Hollywood Reporter. She covers, among other things, 3D TV. Carolyn, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Can we now say that 3D television is finally, at long last, dead?
I think there's a few elements to that conversation.
All right.
As far as the 3D that we know today, where you have the glasses and you sit in front of your TV. I think the public rejected that quite a while ago, to be honest. Okay,
and now businesses are, right? ESPN and the BBC.
Right. From the beginning, we really haven't seen the consumer interest that I think the consumer electronics industry was hoping to see. But there are some technologies that are coming along. One of them is glasses-free 3D.
Glasses-free 3D. Say that 10 times fast.
And
so literally, it would just be 3D without the glasses.
That's correct. It's getting closer to reality. In fact, I think we'll start to see the first glasses-free 3D sets within,
see, it's hard to say,
within the year. Yes.
Really?
It is
now,
hard to
and they're going to cost $1 zillion, probably.
Probably. Yeah. And then there's other things that are further out, you know, holograms, you know, we don't know.
Yeah, CNN's already working on those.
You know, again, I mean, today it's not happening, but further out, I could see depth being part of the home experience.
What was it that killed 3D for consumers today? Was it the glasses and the cost and the new set and all of that stuff?
I think it was a combination of factors. One thing is certainly the glasses. When we watch TV at home, it's not the experience that you have when you're sitting in a movie theater. You're cooking, you have a tablet or a laptop in your hand, you're talking to people, you're at a party. It's not conducive to have to put glasses on in order to watch it. But it's also a chicken and egg scenario. In order for it to work, you need the set penetration, but you also need the available content.
Yeah. What about this idea of the third screen that you alluded to? I mean, a lot of times when we watch television, there's a laptop in our laps or we're walking down the street watching video on our phones or whatever it is, you know? And if it's not on 3D everywhere, then it's on 3D nowhere, I guess.
Interestingly, we could be seeing 3D on tablets.
Am I going to have to walk around with glasses when I'm walking with my iPad?
No, without glasses. Glasses free.
What about the idea that... sometimes 3D just ain't all that. I went to see a movie the other day in 3D, and about 5 minutes after the movie started, I had kind of forgotten that it was 3D, and it's just not all that special anymore.
You make actually a very good point, and I think the creative uses of 3D is another factor in all of this. There have been some exceptional examples of 3D. Life of Pi was very respected. There have been other examples that have been terrible failures, Clash of the Titans being an example.
Yeah, right.
You know, any of these technologies, whether it's the higher resolution or 3D, doesn't mean anything unless there's content that people really want to view.
Carolyn Giardina, she's a contributing tech writer at The Hollywood Reporter. She's got a book out on 3D called Exploring 3D. Thanks a lot for coming into the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the life lessons of a summertime lemonade stand.
They're learning that somebody will give them money if they're 6 and cute.
That's not bad, is it? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 32 points on this Tuesday. That's 0.2%, closed at 15,451. The blue chips did. The NASDAQ down 8 points, 0.25%, 35.98. The S&P 500 off 6 points, 0.3%. 1676 at the bell. Shares of Ford and General Motors took a hit as Goldman Sachs cut its outlook for the auto industry. The bank predicted higher interest rates are going to mean lower car sales. Ford braked 3%, General Motors off 0.9%. Today, Goldman Sachs itself, profits doubled from a year ago, easily beating predictions, but its shares got beat down 1.75% today. General Mills, which makes Hamburger Helper, or these days simply Helper, to its fans, was off 0.1%. A lot of Helper fans listen to this broadcast. I learned yesterday. I heard you. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for June. The Federal Reserve releases its latest Beige Book summary of commentary on current economic conditions. And it spawned generations of humans with mouse ears. Disneyland opened its doors in Anaheim on July 17, 1955. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. I was talking up at the top of the program about the rhythms of capitalism, how there are certain things you can count on happening year after year. Well, for this next story, I could well have said year after year after year after year. Christie's Auction House is a 247-year-old company. It is, in the world of fine art and auctions, the gold standard. But history only gets you so far in the real world of making a buck. You got to deliver, is the message. And in their sales announcement today, Christie's is privately held, so they don't report profits, just sales. They said they're doing pretty well. Stephen Murphy is the CEO of Christie's. We got him in London. Mr. Murphy, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm sitting here looking at your press release about the most recent set of sales you guys have had, the first 6 months of this year. And it's record sales, and you are selling in Shanghai, and you're announcing an auction in Asia. And it seems you're selling everything everywhere nowadays. Business is good.
Business is good. The interest and demand for art is really been developing and almost exponentially every year for the past several years. Our recent sale in New York broke all records for any auction anywhere, ever. The same department has seen a 52% increase in brand new buyers for purchases under $100,000. So it's really happening across the board in terms of investment-wise and purchase-wise and also globally.
As you try to get more people into that under $100,000 market, how do you do it? Do you market? Do you advertise? What do you do?
Until about 20 years ago, it was a little bit, if we build it, they will come.
Yeah.
Because they were dealers. Now, only 20% or so of our clients in the room buying at auction are dealers. The rest are individuals. And so it's our job to both serve our clients better at the top end, but as your question implies, of letting people know through social media, through print advertising.
Oh, my God. Christie's on Twitter? I think the world just exploded.
Yes. Well, why not? That's, you know, our clients are on Twitter.
Yeah.
Our clients are spending 60% of their day online in some screen, so we need to be there too.
I wonder if sometimes just getting to the world of big auction houses, there's you, of course, and Sotheby's. And I wonder whether you feel a little bit like Boeing and Airbus. There's only the two of you. It's you got to get along somehow, but yet you're competitors, and what are you supposed to do?
Well, I like to say this to my team at Christie's. You know, we're the Yankees and the Red Sox.
I should tell you I'm a Yankee fan, but all right.
So am I. I was born in the Bronx. You know, with the Yankees and the Red Sox, and that's a rivalry that does matter. However, it's a much bigger league than just the two of us.
What do you do every day?
My Uncle Fred asks me that question every Christmas.
What do you do exactly? Think of me as your Uncle Fred. I mean, you know, people want to sell stuff, they go to Christie's. I mean, how hard can it be?
Well, you know, I am really proud to be at Christie's. My job when I wake up in the morning is to make sure we have a great environment for creative people to thrive. And that means our team as well as the clients who come to us. What do we do? All we do is create an environment that puts great art and takes great art as a custodian of that art through its life cycle. And nowadays, that path is global. From Los Angeles to London to Shanghai and back again.
If James Christie reanimated tomorrow and showed up in your office, would he recognize what you're doing?
I hope so. I mean that with sincerity. I hope so. I think every great company, and Christie's is a great, great company, is only at its best when it's operating with the tenets of its original intent. And I think I would hope that he would recognize that. He wouldn't recognize what I was wearing, but he might well recognize that the picture on the wall is a constable, and that constable was probably something he looked at and priced in 1826.
Stephen Murphy is the CEO at Christie's. Mr. Murphy, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you for your time.
You got your Google, you got your Amazon, and you got your Tencent. That's 10 Cent. It's a Chinese company, the third biggest internet company on the planet behind the aforementioned numbers 1 and 2. Its messaging service, WeChat, is the world's fastest growing smartphone app. It's only been around for 2 years, but it's got nearly 400 million users, and it's coming soon to a market near you. Our man in China, Rob Schmitz, explains.
If you own a smartphone in China, odds are you're using WeChat. Advertising agency manager Li Jing says most of her phone use is devoted solely to this app. It allows users to text, send walkie-talkie voice messages to each other, share photos and video messages, and it also uses GPS to let you know if friends are nearby.
It's so fast. I no longer have to type messages. When I'm on the go, I can just record a quick voice or video message, and my friend will get it immediately.
But WeChat's popularity doesn't stem so much from how awesome it is, but because Tencent offers it free of charge. And that's meant a big savings for many Chinese who tend to be prolific texters.
If people's social networking activities become more popular on the mobile phone rather than on the computer, it's going to shift the social networking landscape.
Jeremy Goldcorn is founder of the Chinese media blog Danwei. He says as more people shift from laptops to smartphones, so goes social media. He says WeChat is popular because it doesn't push users to post their passing thoughts publicly for all to see, like Facebook or Twitter. It's meant to be a private network between you and your closest friends.
Many people are starting to get fatigue from the public nature of most social networks. And I think it does offer the chance of returning social networking to its actual social origins rather than as a system of public narcissism.
And that's caught on well beyond China's borders. Tencent has hired international soccer star Lionel Messi to appear in ads like this one for the South American market.
WeChat, the new way to connect.
And now Tencent has plans to open an office in the U.S. But the company is, of course, Chinese, and that may be a problem for people worried about privacy, says Jeremy Goldcorn.
American internet companies are going to have a wild time talking about security issues, talking about censorship. I think it's going to be very tough for them to get user acceptance and trust in the United States.
But in light of revelations that the NSA is snooping into emails too, now might be the perfect time for WeChat to give the U.S. market a try. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
You don't get much more into the thick of summer than we are now, and there isn't much that's more American than the lemonade stand. A bunch of kids, paper cups, and a big pitcher of lemonade. Retail price, a quarter, 50 cents maybe. They make some money. They learn a little bit about capitalism in the process. It's a win-win. Or maybe not so much. That's what Michal Lemberger wrote in Slate the other day. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You have taken issue, and I think I'm going to take issue with you. You have taken issue with this quintessential example of American capitalism, the lemonade stand. What is up with that?
Well, I want to make it clear that it's not that I think there's no value in a lemonade stand.
It's not, you know, this shining example of American capitalism, right? It's nothing to teach our kids.
Well, no, it has something to teach our kids. It just doesn't have capitalist value to teach our kids.
All right. Explain that a little bit.
So my children, who are out there for 20 minutes before their shop closed up for the year, they had a great time.
Yeah.
They were, for that brief moment, really the hub of the social experience of that corner.
Yeah.
And that's valuable. But they don't really have a sense of the value of money the way we do.
I wonder, though, whether your problem with this is not with the kids but with the grown-ups, because you talk about in this article quite a bit, you know, grown-ups not only – so it was what, 50 cents a cup for your kids?
50 cents a cup.
50 cents a cup. Okay. They give them a buck and they don't take the change.
Correct.
Or one woman drove by, rolled down her car window and gave your kids $3 and said, no, forget the lemonade.
That's combining two
stories,
the same thing, yeah.
So it's really the grown-ups who are misapprehending what this is all about, perhaps.
Or maybe they're not. I mean, maybe that is what it's all about. Maybe it really isn't about capitalism, as much as that's what we say it's about. And that's why I think the value is social. And for the adults as well, I do think it's social.
I think you're absolutely right. So my kids, last summer, I guess, were hounding me for the lemonade stand, right? So, of course, they squeezed some – actually, they did a decent amount of the work. But I'm schlepping the stuff over, and I'm getting the ice, and I'm doing this, and we're doing the signs. And in the end, they did fine, and they made 10 bucks and whatever. But I was amazed at the number of adults who just drove by, who just didn't stop, didn't glance, didn't do anything. And I the lesson I learned was I am never not going to stop at a lemonade stand now.
Right. See, but you it's are exactly playing into my point. It's not even being a
no,
sucker.
No, it's the social thing. It's exactly. The social thing. I think you're totally right that it's not about capitalism anymore.
No, it's about encouraging children, which you could say is a lesson in capitalism, except that they're not actually learning a capitalist lesson. They're learning that somebody will give them money if they're six and cute.
Cute, right, right, which my kids know, yeah. Okay, so before I let you go, where do you stand on Girl Scout cookies?
Well, they're delicious.
And we'll leave the business aside. Michal Lemberger writes on the lemonade stand and capitalism at Slate. Michal, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me. This has been fun.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today. We told you yesterday that the trial of former Goldman Sachs trader Fabrice Tour has started. He's defending himself against charges he sold mortgage-backed securities that he knew were going to fail. It will be surely a trial in which there will be much Wall Street jargon thrown around. And the judge knows that. She has instructed lawyers in the case to, quote, have a heart and stay away from words like security and collateral and asset-backed. A synthetic CDO is gibberish, she said, unless you explain it. To which we say, hear, hear. If you have questions about what's what at the Tour trial, our Patty Hirsch has a video whiteboard explainer. It's on our website, marketplace.org. And with that, we are done. That is Marketplace from APM. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Justin Ho, and Katie Long on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abeid. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.